Well, we had a scintillating and exciting teen Bible study, as always. The theme for this month is to have it be related somehow to who was Jesus Christ. Before, we were doing who was God, and I came in with an exciting new topic that had never been discussed before and that these people hadn't heard, and it was going to change their whole lives and be a revelation to them. And it turns out that the Lees had already covered it in their home Bible study, and Maddie was able to explain it concisely and clearly to the rest of us, which I found extremely annoying. But it means people are thinking and living God's way and doing it. The two teens who were there can tell you that Mr. Graham was near screaming, but other people, I had to restrain myself, but it was really something. Today, let us turn to 1 Samuel. It's before 2 Samuel. 1 Samuel. And pretty much most of what we're going to be talking about today, these are my notes from Teen Bible Study. I have no idea why I got them out. I thought I was going to start with them. 1 Samuel and chapter 28. And this is mostly where we're going to spend our time around. We'll be in orbit around this chapter. But we're going to look at a story in the history of God's people about Saul and the witch of Endor. That's what it says at the beginning of chapter 28 in 1 Samuel in the Bible that I use. The book of 1 Samuel, I think, is one of the most exciting books when it comes to stories. One of my favorite parts of the whole sweep of God's stories is from 1 Samuel chapter 1, where it talks about the little boy Samuel, up to the very first chapter of 2 Samuel, which is really kind of where the story reaches a temporary ending, at least. And if you haven't read it, it's one of the easiest to read parts of the Bible simply because it is a story. Things happen. And boy, do things happen. They're very strange, impossible, wonderful things that have an impact on us today. But we can learn a lot about our own lives and our own relationship with God and how God actually operates and how the human condition, what it is and what it is like by looking at stories like this. There's a lot more in this than just the actual story, but it'll be our starting point. And what is happening here is that Saul is very near the end of his life. He has reigned in Israel since he was a young man. If you recall, Samuel had been the leader of Israel up to that point, and Samuel is also an interesting character in that he was what is known as a seer, and there's a specific verse. I'm not, by the way, going to go to all the little verses in 1 Samuel that I'm going to talk about. I expect that most of you have read it, and if you haven't, and if you think I'm wrong, go ahead and check up on me. I would love it, because you'll find out all the little details that are included in this book as the story goes along. But Samuel was a seer. It says it's because he really would have been a prophet, but we didn't call people prophets then. That's what the verse says. But the other thing is, it says that he judged Israel, so he was also a judge. And Samuel was the end of an era for the people of Israel in that they begged for a king at that point. Just as an additional interesting detail, the name Saul means asked for. And he wasn't named Saul because he was going to be the king. He was already about 30 years old when they asked for him. So the name was just in place, but it worked out really well. The people asked for him. Samuel said, no, I don't think you want to do that. And the people said, yes, we really do want to do that. And Samuel told them of all the terrible things that would happen. But they ended up getting a king, and the king was Saul. Saul is unique in the history of Israel, well, because he's such a public figure anyway, in that he didn't take the usual role in becoming one of God's servants. If you turn to Hebrews 11, but of course we'll always be going back to 1 Samuel 28, Hebrews 11, which we know of as the faith chapter, when the writer of Hebrews is talking about Enoch, he sums up what human beings do who come to God and what the process is. And in Hebrews 11, verse 6, he happens to be talking about Enoch, but this applies to all of us. Hebrews 11, 6, and without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Saul is an odd character in that he did not seek God. As a matter of fact, if you read the story about Saul as a young man, it's actually funny. And there are actually punchlines in the story where the story stops and says, that's why we say, and then it says, it'll give you what they say, and I don't get the jokes. They're jokes that 3,000 years ago must have been very funny, but I don't get them. But they say, well, here's the punchline, and they tell you. It happens, I think, three times in this book. So it's a funny story in ways that we don't even understand, simply because we don't get all the cultural references at that point. But Saul hid. Saul was out looking for donkeys when God told Samuel to go find him and make him king over Israel. And the reason he chose him was the reason anyone chooses anyone to be the finest person in the land is he was taller than anybody in the nation of Israel. It says, from his shoulders up, he was taller than anyone else. Now, I don't know what that says about him from his shoulders on down, but we do know that if you had a person of average height, that Saul was head and shoulders. That would be our phrase. That Saul was taller, and he was extremely good looking, and that was pretty much the basis of why he was called. He didn't seem to be, I can say this and repent of it in the kingdom, he didn't seem to be one of the brightest people around. As a matter of fact, God did something for Saul that he doesn't do anymore. And it says when he called Saul twice, it says that he changed Saul. He had people go out and play music, and it says at that point Saul changed. Saul was not seeking God. As a matter of fact, what Saul had done right before that was he went and hid with the suitcases. It talks about how God was going to select a king for Israel. Samuel had actually already anointed him, but they got out the Ummim and the Urim and the Thummim and used things like that and also other ways of showing it, and they narrowed it down to Saul's tribe, and they narrowed it down to Saul's father. His father was named Kish, and then they narrowed it down to Saul, and then they said, okay, where is Saul? We know it's Saul, and he was hiding in the suitcases. He really did not want to have any part of this. He found out early on that he got some very good meals if he was king. When Samuel called him, he made him sit at his table, and he called for the finest food and the finest cut of meat and put it in front of Saul, and Saul was pretty impressed by that. But Saul said to Samuel, you know, I really should be looking for my donkeys. He didn't want any part of this. And it said that God's Holy Spirit changed Samuel, and the exact thing that it says is it turned him into a different man. And this affected the way that God looked at Saul, because, as you know, Saul turned into what we would call a villain in the story. And yet, I'm not sure that's the way that God looked at him. I think God always had a tender spot in his heart for Saul because of some of the amusing things that had happened early on. And Saul did do wonderful things for the kingdom of Israel. He actually did fight the Philistines all his life. Samuel, incidentally, had also led war against the Philistines, not by going out to war himself, but Samuel was responsible for overseeing some victories over the Philistines. And Saul and his son Jonathan and some of his better soldiers carried that on. And Israel was still at war with the Philistines when this was happening. At one point, they had actually captured the Ark of the Covenant, and the priest at the time, Eli, had died. And there are two or three chapters devoted, and I am not making this up, to the story of the golden hemorrhoids. And you can look up the original Hebrew and all the different translations, and it really does mean the golden hemorrhoids and the golden mice. And I cannot explain it to you except that God had smitten the Philistines with hemorrhoids. And it affected their lives in very personal ways. And he also gave them an outbreak of mice. And the way that they had to lift the curse was they had to offer, I never thought I would use this phrase in my life, 5 golden hemorrhoids to the eternal God along with mice. You have to look this up. I mean, it's an unbelievable story. And it's part of that. So God had a good time during all of this. There were ups and downs, and a lot of the ups did involve Saul. And I think that's why God kind of gave him some special treatment. There was a point at which Saul disobeyed God. And if you recall, he needed to offer sacrifices before he went into battle. But the rule was he had to wait for Samuel. Samuel was still the one who was the link between Israel and God. Saul was their civil king, but Saul didn't have the direct connection to Samuel, to God that Samuel did. And as a matter of fact, Saul got very used to asking Samuel for advice or consulting the Urim and the Thummim, which were ways that the priests had of finding out what God's will was. We don't know exactly what they were. Or dreams, or other words. And as a matter of fact, there's a curious phrase that's used for Samuel that's not used anywhere else in the Bible, and it says that God spoke to Samuel by speaking in his ear. In other words, Samuel heard voices. And we, you know what we do to people who hear voices today, but Samuel heard voices, and they were from God. And even as he would be looking at things like looking at David's family to see which one he would select, God would be speaking to him and Samuel would actually hear it. But Saul did not enjoy that kind of thing. Saul disobeyed God in that case, and he offered the sacrifices without waiting for Samuel, and Samuel said, "The kingdom will be taken from you." And you would think that would be the end of the story, but it really isn't, because Saul continued to reign at that point and God still continued to bless him. It wasn't until that God told him to wipe out the Amalekite race because of things that they had done to the nation of Israel previously, that God said, this time there's no going back, because Samuel, if you recall, did not kill them all. He left some of the animals, and Samuel showed up and heard the bleating of sheep and the lowing of oxen and said, you were supposed to kill everything. And Saul tried to put a spin on it and said, well, I kept these to sacrifice to God. But he had disobeyed again at that point. So God had forgiven him for some mighty transgressions, but eventually Saul kept disobeying him to the point where God said, all right, that's it. The kingdom will leave from your house and will go to someone else. And this is all a prelude to what's going on in chapter 28. But I think if anyone in the Bible could lay a claim to being a victim, it might be Saul, because Saul never actually wanted to be part of it in the first place. God changed him, and God does not work that way anymore. He didn't do it with David. David had already turned to God when God started working with him, and he doesn't work that way today. So Saul deserves some special consideration because he did serve God in many ways and served the nation of Israel. But by this time, he's already tried to kill David many times. There have been brushes with what we would call mental illness, and also specifically with evil spirits, it's mentioned. An evil spirit would come on him, and he tried to kill David on more than one occasion because of that. And he knew, it had been named to him, that David was going to be his successor. That doesn't seem like a wise thing to do. I would have whispered about it. I would have said, well, I know something you don't know, and I can't tell you what it is. But instead, Saul knew that David was going to be his replacement. As a matter of fact, if you're anywhere near 1 Samuel 28, you can look over at the end of chapter 26, and the story has been going on now for chapters and chapters, and actually for years and years, where David has been fleeing Saul, and Saul has been chasing him. This is one of those instances where David had the opportunity to kill Saul, but did not, because he knew that Saul was special in God's eyes, that Saul was the Lord's anointed, and that things were a little bit different with Saul, and Saul deserved special consideration. And so David says at the end of 26 in verse 23, he said, the Lord rewards every man. He's shouting out to Saul across a valley at this point. The Lord rewards every man for his righteousness and faithfulness. The Lord delivered you, Saul, into my hands today, but I would not lay a hand on the Lord's anointed, because David was a man after God's own heart. As surely as I valued your life today, so may the Lord value my life and deliver me from all trouble. And at this point, it seems that Saul, the beleaguered and set upon, was in his right mind and actually thought like a rational servant of God. Because Saul said to David, may you be blessed, my son David. you will do great things and surely triumph. And Saul knew what he was saying when he said that. What he was saying is that you will succeed me and you will be the ruler of Israel. David went on his way and Saul returned home. Then one of the strangest turns of events that could possibly happen, David, of course, was a man of God, and he was an Israelite, house of Judah, and he wanted God's kingdom, literal in this case, to be fortified. He wanted to beat the Philistines, but Saul was pursuing him, and he was just tired of it, and he said, where can I go? And to sum up chapter 27, he goes to the Philistines, makes friends with their king, joins his army. Then he spends his days wiping out Philistines in different parts of the Negev desert. The king of the Philistines, or at least this king, there was more than one king, says to him, what have you been doing all day, David? And David would say, oh, I went up to the desert and I did some raiding and things like that. He doesn't say, I wiped out a third of your people today. So the king, he's living in the king's household. The king gives him his own city to dwell in with his men and his wives and their children. And David lives this way for some time with the blessing of King Achish. If you read down in verse 10, Achish says, well, where'd you go raiding today? Because David came back, why sugarcoat it with blood on his weapons? David would say, against the Negev of Judah, or against the Negev of Jerahmeel, or against the Negev of Kenites. He's just giving geography. He's just giving map readings at this point. He's not saying, I was slaughtering Philistines. He did not leave a man or woman alive in those slaughters. He was a very bloody man, for he thought they might inform on us and say, this is what David did. In other words, he wanted no witnesses. So with the blessing of the Philistine king, David was wiping out the Philistines, which was what Saul was supposed to be doing at this time. And it says in verse 12, Achish trusted David and said to himself, he has become so odious to his people, the Israelites, that he will be my servant forever. In other words, boy, the Israelites must hate this guy because he's going up to their land and doing raids. And, you know, this day and age with cell phones and internet and stuff, there's no way you could keep that secret. But somehow David came out of it. The word odious is used, but may I say smelling like a rose. He was serving God, he was serving Israel, and he had the blessing of the Philistine king. And not only that, because he was serving in this way, Saul couldn't reach him, and Saul quit chasing him and left him alone. It's unbelievable, and yet it happened. Verse 20, chapter 28, in those days the Philistines gathered their forces to fight against Israel. Achish said to David, you must understand that you and your men will accompany me in my army. In other words, here's the real test. We're going to wage war on Saul and his soldiers, and you're going to be in my army this time. I'm going to watch you. Maybe he had started getting a whiff of what was really going on. David said, oh, great, then you will see for yourself what your servant can do. He said, I'm ready. He was so theatrical about things. Achish replied, very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life. You're going to be my secret service. In verse 3, it mentions, now Samuel was dead, and all Israel had mourned for him and buried him in his own town of Ramah, which was Saul. Samuel made the circuit around Israel, but his home was Ramah, and that's where that's what he used as his home base. And then it said that Saul had expelled the mediums and spiritists from the land. It wasn't Samuel, it was Saul, as king, had gotten rid. And this was something that he was supposed to do as a king. We'll be coming back to 1 Samuel 28, but let's turn to the book of Leviticus and look at what was forbidden. We'll be in Leviticus chapter 20. There's more than one place where it mentions that what we call witches and sorcerers were forbidden in the kingdom of Israel. And we should take a minute to think about what a witch and a sorcerer is. What the verse says in Leviticus 20 and verse 27, Leviticus 20 and verse 27, it says, a man or woman who is a medium or spiritist among you must be put to death. You are to stone them. Their blood will be on their heads. And so none of us are to be mediums or spiritists. Now, what is that? You know, we think of a witch as something that's like that a evil stepmother turns into and poisons the good princess and things. Or we think of witches as people who live in huts by themselves with cats. Nothing against cats, but witches just seem to have cats. And ride brooms around and have warts and pointy hats and things. But what God is actually objecting to is thought that many women over the centuries who've been killed as witches were nothing more than herbalists, people who use natural things to get good results, whether it would be with diseases or other things. But God is talking about something specific here. He says, a man or woman who is a medium or spirit, and notice that it's man or woman, who is a medium or spiritist among you must be put to death. And those are people who contact the world outside, the world that we live in. People who contact beings from God's world. We sometimes use the word angels, but let's just call them spirits at this point. Let's let the angels be the good guys. Let's call them spirits. And a medium is someone who channels one of these spirits and gets information from them in our world. And a spiritist would be someone who contacts those spirits. Now let's turn to Deuteronomy chapter 18. And it expands that a little bit. Deuteronomy verse 18. And of course this is being read to a different audience. This is another generation down the road, and it's talking about things that they are not to do. They're about to receive the nation, the land, and there are things that they are not supposed to do. Deuteronomy 18 and verse 9, when you enter the land the Lord your God is giving you, do not learn to imitate the detestable ways of the nations there. Let no one be found among you who sacrifices his son or daughter in the fire, who practices divination or sorcery, divination meaning dealing with beings that are not part of our world, interprets omens, engages in witchcraft, or casts spells, who is a medium or a spiritist, or who consults the dead. Now, we know technically that you cannot consult the dead. It says in the book of Ecclesiastes that the dead know nothing, and we understand that they are resting and awaiting something else to happen. But there are people today who consult the dead. We know this. And supposedly get messages from them. It was spiritism was a big movement in the United States and in England in the 19th century and the early 20th century, and many notable people took part in it. And there are often good motives for doing so. Many people wanted to contact their departed people whom they missed very much, or many people needed advice, and so they would contact people who would purport, who would claim to put them in touch with the dead. We know that that can't actually happen, except it can. There is actually a way to do it. These people are among us today. My wife and I actually have lived next to a woman who, when I would describe her to other people, I would just say, oh, yes, she's a witch, because that's pretty much how she presented herself. She was a tarot card reader, and she worked with crystals, and she would tell fortunes, and she would give people advice, and people would come to her house on a regular basis. And she also was a fan of the Cleveland Indians and loved her little dachshunds and things like that. She was a gardener. She had nice human pursuits. But she was also a witch. And she was our next-door neighbor. And she wasn't a bad neighbor. She eventually died. But there are people in the world today who do that. It's just matter of fact. They contact a world outside of us. And that is what God is saying. God is saying there is a human experience that you are intended to live, and you are not to go outside of that. And when you think about it, there is a human yearning to go outside of our human experience and have powers that we don't have as humans. Many of our stories talk about this kind of thing. We have superheroes. What are superheroes? What, Superman can fly. Batman can't do much of anything, but he has very cool gadgets to do it with. Other people can start fires or do this or that or become invisible, but these are powers that we don't have, and yet we tell stories about that. Peter Pan can fly. Almost every Disney movie that you think about, every animated Disney movie, has some kind of witch or some figure like that, or we sometimes clean them up a little bit and call them fairies or fairy godmothers or things like that. But if you go through the Disney canon, from Snow White on, there's fairies and witches all the way through, and we like that. And we pay lots of money to go to Disneyland and to see that. I'm not saying that it's all evil to be involved in that. I mean, I loved those movies when I was a kid, and I still own some of them. But you should just be aware that that's part of what's going on there, is that we long for that kind of things. When I was a little kid, I always wanted to fly. I loved dreaming because in my dreams I could fly. And that's not something that a human being could do. What kinds of things do these spirit beings do? Well, they predict, or spiritists, people who contact beings outside our world, what do? They predict the future. They give advice. They tell secrets. In some ways, they find out information that we didn't know. And that's not an impossible thing to do. But what God is saying is, you are a human being. You live as a human being. You do not pursue that kind of thing. And he puts the death penalty on it to show how serious he is. If you recall, one of Jesus' own temptations when he was living as a human, and part of says in Philippians that Jesus accepted his humanity, that he knew he was God, but that he agreed to be human. One of the temptations was, Satan said, if you jump off here, there are spirit beings that will have to catch you. It's not the rules for everybody, but you could contact that world and you have that power. And Jesus actually did have that authority. He had angels who served him food when he needed it, or who comforted him when he needed it. There are scriptures that say this kind of thing. God sent them. Jesus didn't call them. But Jesus sent Satan packing at this point and said, get away from me. He said, this isn't the kind of thing that we do. We don't experiment with this kind of thing. You don't tempt God in this way. If you're a human being, you live the human way. And so they had been put out from the land of Israel by Saul, because he did obey many times. So in 1 Samuel 28, let's read more of the story. In verse 4, the Philistines assembled. They were ready to go to war and came and set up camp at Shunem, while Saul gathered all the Israelites and set up camp at Gilboa. Gilboa was a mountain. When Saul saw the Philistine army, he was afraid, and terror filled his heart, and he was afraid for many reasons. It seems that the evil spirits that troubled him gave him terrors, so he was susceptible to that kind of thing. But even if that wasn't the case, there were specific reasons, and the next verse mentioned it. He inquired of the Lord, and he was used to getting answers. And he didn't usually inquire of the Lord. He inquired of Samuel, who had died, or he inquired of the Urim and the Thummim. I always get that mixed up. And again, we don't know how they work, but they were things that could give direction from God, that God had said it was okay for the priests to use, although not the rank and file people. Or he was used to sometimes having dreams or other instructions, some kind of guidance. But it says in verse 6, he inquired of the Lord, but the Lord did not answer him by dreams or Urim or prophets. Saul then said to his attendants, find me a woman who is a medium so I may go and inquire of her. And it's interesting, the verses in Leviticus and Deuteronomy mention men and women, but here we just assume that if we're looking for a witch, it's a woman. And that's what Saul did. They said, there is one in Endor. Saul disguised himself, putting on other clothes. That's funny. Saul's 7'9". But he disguised himself. He put on other clothes, and at night, so he was trying to take advantage of whatever disguise he could, they went at night, and he and two men went to the woman. Consult a spirit for me, he said, and bring up for me the one I name. This woman, to her credit, said no. She knew what had gone on, and she knew that she was supposed to have put that away, and at this point she didn't know that it was Saul. But without knowing that, she said, I will not do that. And probably she had seen her sisters in the craft get killed or put out of the country. She had seen punishment on the mediums and the spiritists, and she had put all that away. And yet she was still around, and people still knew that she was existed. Saul's assistants had no trouble coming up with her name. So she was a legend, but she was no longer practicing. The woman said to him, surely you know what Saul has done. He has cut off the mediums and spiritists from the land. Why have you set a trap for my life to bring about my death? She gave the right answer. And you could say that she'd even repented from that kind of thing. She knew very well what she had done. You can tell by what happens next. She knew what mediums and spiritists did. and she did it in the way that specifically she was not supposed to, but she'd put all that behind her. Saul swore to her by the Lord, "As surely as the Lord lives, you will not be punished for this." Now, it's of interest to me that Saul is doing this at all, because other people would understand that spirits can't give you anything that God won't give you. As a matter of fact, God can give you much better advice than evil spirits with an axe to grind can give you. And yet Saul, as I said, was never really called. Saul never made the effort to turn to God. He was the reluctant king. And all that he had done because God had actually changed him and enlisted him into his service. And you can see all through the story of Saul that there are ways he behaves where you or someone else who is called to God's way wouldn't even think of behaving. And yet Saul does it. He'd never put out of his mind, even though he'd put the mediums and spiritists away, he still believed in them, apparently, especially at this point when there was absolutely nowhere else he could turn. Then the woman said, "Whom shall I bring up for you?" "Bring up Samuel," he said. And then the next verse is hard to translate. In my Bible it says, "When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out at the top of her voice and said to Saul, 'Why have you deceived me? You are Saul.'" She knew. She had some information that came to her at this point that she knew whom she was talking to, and it was Saul, and there was no question about it. Now, let's look at what happens here. Let's read a few more verses and then figure out what's going on. Verse 13, "The king said to her, 'Don't be afraid. What do you see?' The woman said, 'I see a spirit.'" Actually, it says spirits. It says spirits are gods coming up out of the ground. So this was a general summoning. "What does he look like?" he asked. "An old man wearing a robe is coming up." Then Saul knew it was Samuel, and he bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. Samuel said to Saul, "Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up?" At this point, he's speaking through the woman. "I am in great distress," Saul said, and this is the reason for this whole thing. "The Philistines are fighting against me, and God has turned away from me. He no longer answers me either by prophets or by dreams." It's like Princess Leia talking to Obi-Wan Kenobi. "You're my only help. You're my only hope at this point. So I have called on you to tell me what to do." Samuel said, and this is the way the scripture brings it to us. Samuel said, "Why do you consult me now that the Lord has turned away from you and become your enemy? The Lord has done what he predicted through me. The Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hands and given it to one of your neighbors, to David. Because you did not obey the Lord or carry out his fierce wrath against the Amalekites, the Lord has done this to you today. The Lord will hand over both Israel and you to the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons will be with me in the grave. The Lord will also hand over the army of Israel to the Philistines." Immediately Saul fell full length on the ground, filled with fear because of Samuel's words. His strength was gone, for he had eaten nothing at all that day and night. Let's look at the details of what's happening here, because this can be confusing. We know that the dead know nothing. We know that once you die, you're in the ground awaiting a resurrection. How is it that Samuel is living here? What's going on? Let's notice what didn't happen. Saul did not see anyone. Saul did not hear anyone. The woman saw and heard, and she spoke using Samuel's voice. So what Saul heard and saw was the woman, and that's all he saw. But because the words were directed at him, he assumed that it was Samuel. Samuel was dead, and Samuel was buried. We know that from verse 3. He didn't rise up from the ground. What was happening here is that this woman was a medium or a spiritist, and she could contact spirits in another world who might have had limited abilities at that point because they were spirits who had already thrown in their lot with the people who were against God, with Satan, and being against God's plan at this point. And so that's whom she was contacting. And they were eager to actually to respond. They like this kind of thing. They like messing up human beings. They like messing up what God is doing, if there's any way for them to do it. And so she contacted these spirits, and these spirits knew a great deal. They had access to all of history. They had access to memory. They also had access to what Samuel was and what his spirit was, because there was a spirit in Samuel. And when I say that, I think the phrase that has been used is the software that was Samuel, not the hardware, not the body, because the body is nowhere here. Samuel does not come out of a grave. Remember that. This is all what the witch is telling Samuel. She knows what the process is. She calls the spirits, and the spirits, because they knew what Samuel's spirit was like, they simulated. And they had seen him in life, and they knew his attitudes. Samuel didn't waste a lot of niceness on Saul. They knew how he would talk. And they had already heard Samuel say that the kingdom would be taken away from Saul and that it would be given to another. And so if they knew that much, then they knew that Saul had to be dead and his sons had to be dead. They knew that that was something that would come. And when you know a lot about the way things are and know what's in people's hearts, and these people can tell what's in your hearts, these beings can tell what's in your hearts, then you can go a long way towards predicting the future. And you can imitate Samuel, and you can scare the bejeebies out of the person that he's supposedly talking to, which is King Saul at this point. But there's reasons to know that this is not God speaking, even though Samuel claims to be bringing the word of God to the ears of Saul. That's not what's going on here. There's various ways for us to know this. One is that God doesn't talk this way, Samuel didn't talk this way, and they got a few things wrong, frankly. God had been very forbearing to Saul. And at this point, if Saul had decided that he was going to repent of every evil thing that he had done and turn to God, God would have accepted that. That's the way that it works. Instead, what do we hear? Samuel says, or the being that is pretending to be Samuel, in verse 16, says, "Why do you consult me now that the Lord has turned away from you and become your enemy?" God doesn't talk like that. God never said, "I'm your enemy," to Saul. Instead, he actually forgave him after one of the major transgressions at Gilgal. God let it go and gave Saul another chance. God knew that Saul was doing what God had called him out to do. And so God was kind to Saul over and over again. And David was kind to Saul and spared his life on at least two occasions. And always, there was a third occasion that we'll get to that was very important where David still shows that spirit. And even Samuel looked at Saul with pity. There's a point after Saul had disobeyed God in not killing everything that belonged to the Amalekites, all the people or all the animals. And Samuel said, it said at the end of that chapter, I think it's chapter 15, that Samuel did not go up to see Saul anymore after that. And people have mistakenly thought that Samuel never saw Saul again. But what really happened was that David fled Saul's presence. And where did he go? He, for a while, went around the wilderness of Palestine, but he finally fled to the prophet Samuel for some kind of comfort and advice and safety. And Samuel took him to his headquarters, which was a place called Naoth, which just means huts. It just means houses. Samuel had a little village built, which was full of his people. And as long as God's spirit was there, David was safe. And Samuel nursed David back to health. And in that time, they spoke to each other about many things because Samuel and David's paths really didn't cross all that much from the day that David was called. But in that time, they talked to each other. And you can read in the book of Chronicles all the things that Samuel and David planned together during that time about what would be the temple service and how things would be laid out once God had built a temple. And those were the days when that happened. But Saul heard that David was hiding with Samuel, and Saul went out to drag David out of the huts and kill him. What happened was that Saul sent out his mightiest, his most ferocious, his hugest, most terrible musicians to stand between him and David and King Saul and his armies. And the musicians played, and the soldiers sang. They couldn't help it. The Spirit made them do it. Saul heard about this, and he said, "Oh, I'm going myself." And Saul went to drag David out personally, and the mighty musicians came out and started playing their music, and Saul took off his clothes and started singing along, and there's a punchline there that says, "Is Saul also among the prophets?" But it was the second time that it happened. The first time that it happened, the joke was told respectfully. At this point, the joke was not told respectfully. It was a shameful thing for Saul to be there, undressed and singing at this point, and totally helpless in the face of these formidable musicians. But it says one more thing. It says that Samuel went out and looked at Saul. And you can tell by the way that it's worded that there was pity in his heart, and that this great being who had once led Israel and routed the Philistines was now a pitiable character. Samuel did look at him, and so Samuel did not speak this way to Saul. He would never say, God is your enemy. There's going to be terrible things happen from you. As a matter of fact, he was saying, he would say things like, if you don't turn, if you don't keep obeying God, terrible things will happen to you. That's the way that Samuel talked. God himself didn't talk that way. God was forbearing towards Saul also. If you read the story, you see that from the beginning to the end. But God indeed was going to tear the kingdom out of Samuel's hand and give it to another. That was very well known, and the fact that it was David was also well known. And so in verse 18, the Spirit says, because you did not obey the Lord or carry out his fierce wrath against the Amalekites, the Lord has done this to you today. The Lord will hand over both Israel to you and the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons will be with me. That's not the way Samuel would talk. That's the way an evil spirit who has an axe to grind against God would talk. An evil spirit who thinks that God is wrong and that God doesn't trust his spirits and that God is their enemy. And everything, just because they had set out to do things that weren't the way God wanted them to do them, he had cast them out and no longer wanted anything to do with them. That's the way that evil spirits talk. But it had its effect. Verse 20, immediately Saul fell full length on the ground, filled with fear because of Samuel's words. His strength was gone, for he had eaten nothing all that day or night. And then this woman who had formerly been a witch, because remember she had been tricked into doing it this time. She had put it away. She had repented, if you will. This woman showed great kindness at this point. I can't help thinking that maybe God was behind this woman's kindness. When the woman came to Saul and saw that he was greatly shaken, a witch would go, ha, 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 and something about my pretty, and set things on fire, and cast curses and toads and warts and things at him. But this woman, this kind woman, came to Saul and said that he was greatly shaken. And he was destroyed at this point. She said, look, your maidservant has done exactly what you told me to do. I took my life in my own hands and did what you told me to do. I didn't want to do it, but you made me do it. Now please listen to your servant and let me give you some food so that you may eat and have the strength to go on your way. He refused and said, I will not eat. This is not the way that witches talk. This is the way that kind people talk. But his men joined the woman in urging him, and he listened to them. He got up from the ground and sat on the couch. The woman had a fatted calf at the house. Now, people kept this fatted calf around for special occasions, or it was going to get them through the year. It wasn't a casual thing to just say, oh, fatted calf, kill it. She had one fatted calf. It was what she had. It was the food for her household. And she commanded, well, she herself butchered it. And she also made bread at that point, so it took a little bit of time, but they had the night. She set it before Samuel and his men, and they ate. That same night they got up and left, but he left with a meal in his stomach. And it was because of the kindness of this woman. This woman, to me, shows intelligence and compassion and grace in this situation, and it is possible that you and I will be talking to her again at some point. You know, she seems like the type of person who could turn to God's way of life. And as a matter of fact, she had put the old ways behind her, whether out of fear or whether out of some form of repentance. And that's all that we know about her. Then amazing things happen. Before the Philistines fight Saul, amazing things happen. David, in fighting with the Philistines, the Achish decides that David might not be worthy of fighting in his army. That David might be worth keeping an eye on, because if you look in chapter 29 down in verse 5, Achish finally comes to his senses and says, isn't this the David that they sang about in their dances? Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. So David doesn't want to fight for the Philistines, and he's praying to God, I'm sure at this point. He says, there is absolutely no way this can work out, but please do something. So Achish calls David and says, look, as surely as the Lord lives, interesting choice of words, isn't it? Because these are the pagan Philistines. You've been reliable. I have no reason to complain about you. You've been a servant of mine from day one. From the day that you came to me till now, I have found no fault in you. It isn't me, David, but those other people don't want you to fight. So I'm really, really sorry about this, but you can't fight Israel in my army today. And David says, oh, no. You know, he probably was smiling at that point. You know, David's saying, I've been delivered. And what does David go out and do? Chapter 30. Look at chapter 30. Do you have a heading for chapter 30? David destroys the Amalekites, who are the people that Saul got in trouble for not destroying. David goes out and does God's work at this point, and he does it with the full blessing of the Philistines. This is impossible stuff. You could make a fantastic movie out of this kind of thing. But there is so much that's happening at this point. The Amalekites have raided the city where he left his wives and children and where his men's wives and children were. And it's worth reading on your own. So he went out and pursued them, got them all back, and wiped them out in the process. So everything's coming to a head here except the terrible thing, which is the Philistines attacking Israel and killing Saul. But the reason that this is important, and as you look at this, the reason that this is important is that there are days worth of events here. And when you read in 2 Samuel in verse 1, you realize that this took place over a period of days. And it's difficult to do the chronology of this, but it looks as though the spirit being was wrong and gave Saul wrong information. Because what did the spirit being say? He said, tomorrow you and your sons will sleep with me. You'll be with me. And it looks as though it took several days for that to happen. So the spirits made the most of the drama of the situation, but they didn't get the details entirely correct. And you can read all that happened in chapter 31. The Philistines fought against Israel. The Israelites fled against them. Many fell slain on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines pressed hard after Saul and his sons, and they killed his sons, and it's just casually here, Jonathan, who was David's very best friend in the world, who David said in a totally innocent way, the sinless way, said that Jonathan meant more to him than the love of women. Abinadab and Malchishua. The fighting grew fierce around Saul, and when the archers overtook him, they wounded him critically, and this was the end of Saul. Saul said to his armor-bearer, draw your sword and run me through, or these uncircumcised fellows will come and run me through and abuse me. So he was fearful to the end of his life that he was even going to die badly. His armor-bearer was terrified and wouldn't do it, so Saul took his own sword and fell on it, and this is what actually happened. Saul fell on his sword, and the armor-bearer was terrified at that point, too. He basically lost his mind and fell on his own sword also. Then Saul and his three sons and his armor-bearer and all his men died together the same day. When the Israelites along the valley and those across the Jordan saw that the Israelite army had fled and that Saul and his sons had died, they abandoned their towns and fled, and the Philistines came and occupied them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head, and at this point, of course, they wouldn't have noticed that there were some things missing from Saul, that his crown and that his armband were not there. A thief had come through and stolen them, but Saul had died at this point. This turns out to be important later. They sent messengers throughout the land of Philistines to proclaim the news in the temple of their idols and among the people. They put his armor in the temple of the Ashtoreths and fastened his body to the wall of Bethshan. Doesn't say what happened to his head. When the people of Jabesh-Gilead, who were Israelites, heard of what the Philistines had done to Saul, all their valiant men journeyed through the night to Bethshan. They put their lives on hold and gave their lives to rescue the bodies of Saul and his sons for the honor that they deserved at that point, for he had been an anointed one of the Lord of Israel. They took down the bodies of Saul and his sons from the wall of Bethshan and went to Jabesh, where they had buried them. Then they took their bones and buried them under a tamarisk tree at Jabesh, and they fasted 7 days. These were the good people of the earth doing what was right at that point. We'll look at 2 Samuel 1 quickly. After the death of Saul, David returned from defeating the Amalekites and stayed in Ziklag 2 days. So there was a lot going on at this point, and it took a while for it to happen. On the third day, a man arrived from Saul's camp. And this was after Saul had died, but before the Philistines had gotten the bodies. So time had gone by. With his clothes torn and dust on his head, when he came to David, he fell to the ground to pay him honor. Now, it looks like this is a good guy. It turns out it's not. Where have you come from? David asked him. David should have been happy at this point. He was now almost uncontested as leader of Israel. It turns out there was still more to do, but what happened? David asked. Tell me. The young man said, the men fled from battle. Many of them fell and died, and Saul and his son Jonathan are dead. Then David said to the young man who brought him the report, how do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead? They'd fallen on their swords. There were no witnesses to tell at that point. God must have delivered that, or some soldier must have seen it happen and got the true story to David. In verse 6, I happened to be on Mount Bilboa, said the young man. You know, just happened to be there. Just happened to be there. He was robbing the bodies was what he was doing. There was Saul leaning on his spear and the chariots and riders almost upon him. When he turned around and saw me, he called out to me and said, what can I do? And he asked me, who are you? An Amalekite, I answered, like it would matter at that point. And he said to me, stand over me and kill me. I am in the throes of death, but I'm still alive. So I stood over him and killed him, because I knew that after he had fallen, he could not survive. The logic there is staggering. And I took the crown that was on his head and the band on his arm and have brought them here to my lord. David and all the men with him took hold of their clothes and tore them. They mourned and wept and fasted till evening for Saul and his son Jonathan and for the army of the Lord and the house of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword. The young man thinks he's in a pretty good place here, because he's brought back the symbols of Saul's kingship to David, and that David will reward him in the way that he so richly deserves. Of course, what he had done was stolen them off Saul's body. David said to the young man, who brought him the report? Where are you from? I'm the son of an alien, Amalekite, he answered. David asked him, why were you not afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed? And at that point, you can imagine the young man's stomach dropping. This wasn't the way it was supposed to go. Then David called one of his men and said, go strike him down. So he struck him down, and he died. For David had said to him, your blood be on your own head. Your own mouth testified against you when I said, I killed the Lord's anointed. David said, that's not the way that we treat the Lord's anointed. So one more opportunity David had to show his devotion to God and his pity and respect for King Saul at this point. Then David took up a lament, a song, because that's the way David reacted to life, concerning Saul and his son Jonathan, and ordered that the men of Judah be taught this lament of the bow, as it is written in the book of Jashar. And David ends with this beautiful ode to Saul and Jonathan. And in verse 24, he ends it by saying, well, verse 23, Saul and Jonathan, in life they were loved and gracious. In death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. They had brought prosperity to Israel and deliverance from the Philistines up till that point. How the mighty have fallen in battle. That's where this phrase comes from. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. How the mighty have fallen. The weapons of war have perished. And that's where we will close the book on this story. There is much more to read, and I strongly encourage you to read the rest of the book of 1 Samuel. It's a very fast read, and you'll be delighted by some of the things and turned off by some of the things. But what can we learn from the story that we've read about Saul and the Witch of Endor? We can learn that characters aren't everything they seem. That although Saul seems like he's a villain, he was a man much to be pitied, and in some ways did have victim status, and that God had used him in a very specific way. And because of that, God and Samuel and David had given Saul respect that you wouldn't think he would deserve. But they gave it to him not only during his life, but even after he had been killed. We learn that spiritists and mediums can do some things but not others. They can contact beings who know a great deal, and they can simulate things that make us afraid or make us make decisions, but that we really have nothing to fear because it's all a sham at that point. We get our knowledge from God and from truth, and from the world around us and from what is right. And the reason we do it is because God has told us that in no way ever are we to consult spiritists or mediums. We can also learn that the way that history works out is often in the most impossible ways. I mean, the story of King David killing the Amalekites is just unbelievable, and being in the Philistine army, and that good did work out just as God had said it would, and things worked out the way that God had proclaimed, that David would indeed be the next king. And you know, he didn't have to be, because although Saul and his sons had been killed, the royal family was still alive. They were grandsons, and they come into the story a little later. But it was so obvious at this point to the nation of Israel. It took a few more years, but they eventually gave David the kinghood. There's much that we can learn from taking a close look at just one chapter of God's Word. To me, it's like a hologram. A hologram, you know, is a 3D image that can be displayed when you shine a laser through it. But the thing about a hologram is that the finer you slice it, the image is still there. It might lose a little resolution, but by looking very closely at a small thing, we can learn many details about our great and glorious God.